Thank you, Andrew. And thank you to all of you for bringing all these wonderful harvest gifts. Psalm 34 says, "Come, taste and see that the Lord is good." And at harvest time, that's what we celebrate, isn't it? So, I don't know, what's your favourite thing that you really give thanks for at harvest time? Anybody got any special favourites? Tomatoes, says Phyllis. Especially if you've grown them yourself. And if they haven't, ours are bursting, actually. Yeah, but they do taste good, don't they? When they're fresh out of your own garden. Yes, tomatoes. Any other things that you really think... Sorry?
Plums.
There's something about the word, isn't there? Plump plums. And they, yeah. Yes, we've got them just falling off our trees. Yeah.
Ambrosia rice.
Sorry?
I enjoyed ambrosia
rice. Yeah, thank you, Joy. Yes. Probably goes with plums. I'm going to pick out Julie's loaf here, actually, because I think that's wonderful. I don't know if you can catch a glimpse of that, but she put a picture of it on Facebook, so we all had a little advance notice of that. So there we are. Isn't that lovely? Lovely harvest loaf. Can you see the mouse here?
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. So thank you very much, Julie, for doing that. In fact, harvest, as we have it now, is two festivals. It started on, I think, the 1st of August with the very first crops from the fields, and they call that Lammas, which was originally loaf mass. So it was Thanksgiving for the first wheat, the first loaf that they made. And then, of course, round about now was, if you like, the last of the harvest, and so that was what became our date for harvest festival. But isn't it good to give thanks for all the good things that God provides and showers upon us? But when I saw these readings, I thought, oh my goodness, what are we? They're not very thankful, are they? You know, they're a bit fierce, aren't they? But then I thought about them, and I thought, actually, it's good, isn't it, occasionally, not just to have the carrot, but to have the stick, to hear from Jesus his warnings that we really should be thankful and grateful and give to those in need. Because the parable that Jesus told about the rich man and the poor man is, firstly, I think, about inequality, about rich and poor and the gap between them. One of the most powerful books I think I've ever read is this one, The Spirit Level by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And my brother actually forced it on me. He said, "You ought to read this." All right, thank you, Neil. And it sat on my shelf for a while because I thought it looked a bit dull, to be honest. It's by a couple of economists, it tells you at the back, and economics I always thought was a bit boring. But when I started it, I was absolutely gripped. Because although they're economists, they prove again and again with evidence and figures that the wider the gap between rich and poor in any society, the more people suffer. All sorts of things like mental illness and national health and so on, all sorts of things are worse when there's a big gap between rich and poor. Greater inequality leads to problems throughout society, whereas reducing the gap between rich and poor makes everybody happier, not just the poor, but it makes rich and poor much happier throughout society. So I recommend that, and in fact, ever since I read it, I've seen it quoted in newspapers, in magazines, on television, even in the Houses of Parliament. Highly recommended. But the sad truth is that at this moment, the gap between rich and poor in Britain is getting wider, not narrower. The inequality is increasing between rich and poor. The second focus of Jesus' parable is about justice and judgment. We don't know how Dives, as he's sometimes called, and Lazarus, the rich man and the poor man, we don't know how they became rich and poor. But Jesus says in the story, he says, the poor man died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side, to Abraham's bosom, while the rich man was buried and he suffered torment in Hades. So you can see what God might think of the two of them. And the rich man begs for help. But Abraham replies that judgment is evening things up again. He had good things in life, and now the poor man is being comforted. Justice is being done. Inequality is being reversed. And I guess it's true that the greater the inequality in life, the greater the reversal will have to be in eternity. And besides, says Abraham in the story, the verdict is final. You can't swap sides. Well, in that case, says the rich man, please warn my family. Nope, says Abraham, they've had their warning already. Oh, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they'll repent. And Jesus replies, no, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. And I think that's the most poignant phrase because, of course, Jesus knows that in a few days' time after he said this, he will go to his own death on the cross and then he will be raised from the dead. But even then, even faced with that ultimate proof, some will refuse to repent and believe. Warnings alone are not enough to persuade everyone. Now, I think that's something that is worth us remembering as we begin to think about mission. That you can't convince everyone. You can't expect total success. That there are some people who, no matter how well you put it, are going to say, no, I'm not having it. Even Jesus, who, let's face it, was the best missioner ever, even Jesus could not convince everyone. Even when he walked on water, even when he gave them food multiplied, even when he rose from the dead, still there were some who said, no, I refuse to believe. So in other words, our responsibility is not to succeed, it's not to convince everyone, it's simply to be faithful and tell them the good news. And then how they respond is their choice. It's between them and God. Warnings alone are not enough to persuade everyone. This is a decision of the heart for the individual. And Amos, that little reading from Amos that John read, is likewise very stern, isn't it? About those who live in luxury and don't care about the sufferings of the poor. So what can we do? What can we do, Vicar? How should we respond? Well, I'm going to suggest three things briefly, if I may. Righteousness, thankfulness, and generosity. Righteousness. By righteousness, I don't mean being a good person, behaving well, and being nice to kittens. Because that's self-righteousness. What I mean is keeping a good relationship with God in Jesus Christ, knowing that he died to forgive my sins. And if you haven't asked him to forgive you, you can do that today, anytime, in fact. If you want to start a friendship with him, you can start today. Ask somebody who knows. Ask a friend. How do I become a Christian? How do I make a friendship with Jesus? That's the most important thing of all. Because righteousness comes through Christ, not through good works and good behavior. But when you're in that close relationship with God, then you will begin to want to right injustice, to even up the inequalities, to feed the poor man at the gate. But the first thing is to get straight with God As a preacher once said, keep the main thing the main thing. Get straight with God. Number one was righteousness. Number two is thankfulness. When we're given good gifts, we should never forget to say thank you, should we? It pleases the giver. It reminds us of what good things we have. It frees us up from thinking that this is our rightful property, that somehow we own all these wonderful things. I'm speaking to myself because this week we changed our car and got a new car. I've got to remember who gave us these things and not think, oh, haven't I done well? Aren't I wonderful? Thankfulness is one key to that, isn't it? And the experts have proved that one way to get happier in your life very quickly is to be thankful, to be grateful. One of the quickest ways to make yourself happy. Righteousness, thankfulness, and third, generosity. What should the rich man have done? How would you advise him? How should he have lived his life? Well, given food to the poor man, lying at his front door, of course, the man who was starving, longing just to eat the scraps from the floor under his table. But it's a remarkable paradox in our world that it's the richest people who are often the most mean and tight in life, whereas many of the poorest people are generous and giving. People who visit India come back astonished that they went to a little hut out in the fields and they knew these people only had sort of 2 eggs or something, and they were given those for their lunch. Rich, fat Westerners were given the best food by the poor people. You find it right across Britain as well. The Church of England keeps statistics for how many people worship in each church and how much the collections are, how much is given. And again, you find that people who are poor up in Bradford or wherever it is give more per head than people down in Surrey and Sussex and Kent and so on. And you think, how can that be? It ought to be the other way round. But it isn't. There's something funny about people, that somehow money and wealth seem to be almost addictive to human beings. And we fall into their grasp, and we find it very hard to escape. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. But God has provided us with a way to escape, an escape route. And that route is generous giving. Because when we give, we sort of loosen and release the grip of wealth on our hearts. We're celebrating today all the good things that God has given us. And compared to most of the world, the vast majority of the world, we are wealthy. Even the poorest person here today is vastly wealthy compared to most in our world. We've received many good things. But Jesus warned the rich. Amos warned the rich, watch out, because you can fall into temptation and sin. So I want to suggest 3 things that we can do. 1, righteousness. Stay close to God. And that way you'll keep the right perspective. 2, thankfulness. Be thankful, consciously, be grateful. Say thank you for all the good things that we have. And 3, generosity. Give generously. Open your hands, open your hearts, and give to those in need.